This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Earlier today, Britain released a report on the quality of British pre-war intelligence in the run-up to the war in Iraq. The Butler Report, named after the lead investigator, Lord Robin Butler, concluded that Iraq did not have significant, if any, stocks of chemical or biological weapons ready for deployment. That finding is a blow to the British government, which used this threat as one of its main justifications for going to war. But while the report says several of the intelligence sources were seriously flawed, it found no deliberate distortion or culpable negligence had occurred. The Butler Report comes a week after the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee issued its own findings on intelligence on Iraq, heaping much of the blame on the CIA, while also noting that it was a global intelligence failure. Later in the program, the UN's new employee, his job to prevent genocide and citizens on the lookout for terrorist activity. But first, an inside look at the Butler Report and what it might mean for politicians here and abroad. If you have questions about the British report, give us a call. Do you think these reports in the U.S. and Britain go far enough in investigating intelligence failures? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Michael Mates. He is a member of the Butler Commission and the ranking minority member of the Intelligence and Security Committee in the House of Commons. He joins us by phone from his office in London. Thanks so much for being with us today on Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure.
Could you just summarize for us the findings of the Butler Report?
Yes. The first finding you've already mentioned, nobody did anything deliberately wrong any more than it happened to your side of the Atlantic. But there was a collective intelligence failure. We thought Saddam had these weapons. You thought he had them. Other Western intelligence services whom we spoke to during the course of our inquiry all thought he had them. The fact is, all of that intelligence was wrong. We've tried to look at how that was got wrong, what flaws there were in a system which can deliver such a wrong judgment, and then what use was made of it by our politicians.
And what faults did the Butler Commission cite?
Well, the first thing is, for people, and I think people both sides of the Atlantic are now starting to understand better the limits of intelligence. People think that if you get an intelligence report that such and such is so, that is an end of it. It's not, of course. If you had if you knew the facts, that's different from intelligence. Intelligence gives you guidance on which you have to make judgments, and you have to be very careful, first of all, with your sources and their reliability. You fell foul of that with the dissidents and the alternatives, the shalabis of this world. We fell foul of it because the chain of sources was too long and was not properly verified all the way down the chain. And what's happened, both sides again, is that many of the sources on which both of our intelligence services relied were not telling the truth, but hadn't been properly checked out.
Well, as you know, Prime Minister Tony Blair reacted to the Butler Report in the House of Commons this morning. We have an excerpt from his remarks. We're going to listen to that tape right now.
As the months have passed, it seems increasingly clear that at the time of invasion, Saddam did not have stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons ready to deploy. The second issue is therefore this. Even if we acted in perfectly good faith, is it now the case that in the absence of stockpiles of weapons ready to deploy, the threat was misconceived and therefore the war was unjustified? I have searched my conscience not in a spirit of obstinacy, but in genuine reconsideration, in the light of what we now know in answer to that question. And my answer would be this, that the evidence of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction was indeed less certain, less well-founded than was stated at the time. But I cannot go from there to the opposite extreme. On any basis, he retained complete strategic intent on weapons of mass destruction and significant capability. The only reason he ever let the inspectors back into Iraq was that he had 180,000 US and British troops on his doorstep. He had no intention of ever cooperating fully with the inspectors, and he was going to start up again the moment the troops and the inspectors departed or the sanctions eroded.
Michael Mates, as a member of the Butler Commission, what was your reaction to Mr. Blair's comments?
Well, no one would argue with anything that you've just heard. But the real point was that here we had, again, both sides of the Atlantic, a war about which there was much controversy, much more than any, certainly, we've had in the past. The Falklands War, it was quite clear the Falkland Islands had been invaded. In the first Gulf War, it was as clear to us as it was to you in the United States that Saddam had to be removed from Kuwait. But here was a different sort of war, when the threat was there, so we all honestly believed, but it wasn't an immediate threat. Saddam wasn't immediately threatening either the United States or the United Kingdom. What, of course, changed all of these perceptions was 9/11 and the trauma that you went through. And the question now, which people will be asking, is, well, if you hadn't ratcheted up what you thought you knew, would you have persuaded the British public and, more important, Prime Minister Blair's Labour Party? That is the debate that is now starting. I've heard echoes of it, your side of the Atlantic. I've heard people saying, your side, well, the Senate would not have voted for war if they'd known that the intelligence wasn't right. It is a new situation. We have found faults. The Prime Minister has accepted all of our recommendations, which is something. And we tried to not only look back at past failings, but draw lessons for the future. And we've drawn lessons for the future in that the machinery of our intelligence needs looking at on the basis that the threats are now much more diverse and widespread and harder to gain intelligence on. I mean, if one goes back now to the Cold War and the easy days when you had the Soviet bloc and the West, finding out what they had and what their intentions were was a million times easier than finding out what bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and all these groups have got, because they are in such tiny cells. And we now need to recast, and as I believe you do too, the intelligence services to mark this new threat and to give us better intelligence on which to base these judgments.
It seems as if John Scarlett, then chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, was the only politician to receive much heed in this report. Shouldn't other politicians also be held accountable somewhere in this?
Well, John Scarlett, of course, is not a politician. John Scarlett is a civil servant. He has, I mean, in your terms, he's a long-term serving member of our equivalent CIA. And he was chairman of a Joint Intelligence Committee, which you don't have, and if I may make so bold as to suggest it would be a rather good thing if you did, to bring all of your people together with the policymakers to try and thrash this out. I think it's one of the things that many people in the United States administration wish they had, and who knows, it may even come as a result of the row over George Tenet and the CIA's failings. So John Scarlett's not a politician. Be quite clear about that. He's a career civil servant in our terms. The politicians who were responsible were the policymakers. And you've got to read the report to find out that if you've got a collective failure, and that is what has been acknowledged by the Prime Minister to be a collective failure, the guy responsible is the chap at the top of the tree.
So somebody does need to be held accountable.
Well, the Prime Minister, and he said, I take responsibility for the mistakes that were made.
And so he may be held accountable electorally.
That is for the electorate to say. It's for the House of Commons to say next week when there's a vote on the subject.
One other thing, your party, the Conservative Party, boycotted this inquiry, is that correct?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. The Liberal Democrats boycotted it altogether. My leader, Mr. Michael Howard, withdrew his support when he thought that the inquiry was not going to look into the use made of intelligence and the policy that was derived from it. In fact, we did look at that. I stayed on because the rest of the other four members asked me to stay on, and I haven't fallen out with my leader over this. We both understood each other's position.
And was the committee at all divided over the conclusions in the report?
No, the committee was unanimous, as any committee that's going to be listened to must be.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Mates is a member of the Butler Commission and is ranking minority member of the Intelligence and Security Committee. He joined us by phone from his office in London. Joining us now to talk more about the findings of the Butler Report is Nick Fielding, a senior reporter for the Sunday Times of London. He joins us by phone from his home in Oxford. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I know you've been looking at the report today. You just heard what Michael Mates had to say. What's your own reaction?
Well, I think the difficulty with the conclusions of the Butler inquiry is that yet again, this is the fourth inquiry that we've now had into various aspects of intelligence and the war in Iraq. Yet again, there appears to be nobody who's conclusively guilty of anything.
Right.
And I think this is going to be a problem, in a sense, for Tony Blair in the longer term. It's the Prime Minister certainly wants to bring this whole affair to an end. And yet, because there is no clear outcome of this, as Butler himself said, it's a collective operation, no single individual to blame, the likelihood is that the public and particularly sections of the media will be very keen that this continues until there is somebody to blame. And whether it is, as Mr. Mates suggested, something which goes all the way up to the Prime Minister, or whether it settles on John Scarlett, the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and shortly to be the head of our External Intelligence Service, MI6, or whether it is to be somebody else, it's not at all clear. And I think that, for that reason, this is a very unsatisfactory report. I must say it's fairly typical of the kind of reports that are done under these circumstances. They're sort of designed to be as clear as possible without drawing any conclusions, and I think that it's slightly saddening, to be honest with you, that there are not clear ideas of how an agency which costs something like £1 billion a year in this country was incapable of providing evidence to the politicians, which could be absolutely conclusive.
Well, no politicians were held accountable. The report did criticize the informality of the Blair government's, the way Tony Blair does business, really, his informal discussions with aides and that sort of thing.
That's absolutely true, and I think it will come as a sort of it will come as a revelation to students of government to see that the cabinet was discussing and taking decisions over the over such something as important as the war in Iraq without seeing position papers. In other words, these were discussions without documents. The documents were kept to a much smaller group of ministers who dealt with things on a day-to-day basis in a smaller committee. And yet, despite the fact that matters were discussed over 20 times within the cabinet, at no time were cabinet members given access to the documentation that was available and may have influenced their decisions.
Did Mr. Blair say anything that surprised you today in Parliament, or was his response pretty much what you might have expected?
Well, I think obviously there had been a lot of thought going into how he's going to respond. This had been a matter which I think was troubling him enormously, the way in which this report was going to fall for him, and I think he was tremendously concerned about it. He was very keen. I mean, in his speech, he was very keen to say no one lied. No one inserted things in the dossier against the advice of the intelligence services, and that there were the strategic intent and capability on the behalf of Saddam Hussein's regime to produce weapons of mass discrimination, weapons of mass destruction. I think that's the best he could possibly make of a bad job. The problem with this, the Butler inquiry and the previous inquiry, the Hutton inquiry, neither of them have discussed the political dimensions of this whole debate.
And we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
We're going to get into the political discussion after we take a short break, so please stay with us. We are talking about a new report on pre-war intelligence in Britain. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the Butler Report, an assessment of British pre-war intelligence in the run-up to the war to Iraq. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With me now is Nick Fielding. He's a senior reporter for the Sunday Times of London. And, Nick, we're going to try and take a call now. We're going to go to Craig, and he is in San Francisco, California. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn, for taking the call. Yes, you know, it's very interesting that the reports are coming out. I must say, and I think that this might be reflected in other people's views, that both reports seem somewhat disingenuous. They seem to sidestep the whole issue, which seems to be really the most important issue, of how the intelligence was used and what was communicated to the publics, both on the British side and American side. That, I think most people think, is really the issue that needs to be looked at. We all know that politicians and people who are in the know of intelligence are savvy people, and that intelligence always has to be taken with judgment. And what you do with that judgment and that information and how you try to whip up like emotions in terms of using that intelligence, I think most people would be benefited by a focused investigation, an independent, public, and thorough investigation into the use of that information and how it was communicated to the public. I think that would be the biggest sign of a real democracy, both in America and the United States.
Nick Fielding, is this the remarks that Craig is making, which certainly a sizable number of Americans would agree with? What's the public opinion on that in Britain?
Well, I think there is an appetite for exactly those things, an independent inquiry somehow to understand how it could be that intelligence, which now has been shown to be inaccurate, but which many of us, certainly in the media, people who were working on these kind of issues and stories at the time, could never understand how the decisions have been made. This needs to be brought out. And as I say, we've had four inquiries in the UK now, none of which have addressed these very particular points. And that is extremely frustrating. But I think also it means it's going to be very hard for the Prime Minister to get closure on this matter, because the issues are going to continue rumbling around, and I think they're going to do fairly substantial damage.
All right, thanks for your call, Craig.
Thanks very much for your time.
Joining us now to take a look at how British intelligence works and how it compares to U.S. intelligence agencies is Paul Wilkinson. He's a professor of international relations at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he joins us by phone from his home in Scotland. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Mr. Wilkinson.
Hello.
I guess the real question that comes out of all this is, how is it possible that two of the largest intelligence agencies in the world, from two world leaders, the two major democracies, could have gone so wrong on their intelligence leading up to the war in Iraq?
Well, this certainly is a major puzzle. And I think what is revealed both by the reports in the United States and the Butler report is the huge gaps in the knowledge of Iraq on the part of the intelligence agencies. They simply were relying on the information from exiles who had a obvious political motivation for trying to induce the United States and its allies to attack Iraq and topple Saddam. So their testimony should have been treated with some caution and skepticism. And in fact, much of it was accepted and taken as read without any corroboration. Of course, there's also the very serious problem that learning about the intentions and plans of a secretive dictator like Saddam is an extraordinarily difficult task for intelligence agencies, which are heavily reliant on technical intelligence and lacking in good quality human intelligence from agents within the country concerned. And I think those weaknesses have been found in not only the United States intelligence community, but of course in the European intelligence communities, not just in Britain. So this is a general weakness of the Western intelligence communities. No one really had a clear idea of the precise state of Saddam's armory. And that is why, in my view, Hans Blix should have been given the chance with his inspectors to have gone ahead and completed their task. And, of course, if we'd given them the chance to do that, they would have discovered what we now know to be the case.
But he was not given the chance to do that.
He wasn't given a chance.
And, you know, all of this, I think, leaves the intelligence agencies certainly vulnerable to the question of whether or not they were eager to provide the information to the political leaders that the political leaders wanted to hear.
Well, I think that's certainly a danger that has been highlighted by many experienced observers. For example, Tom King, previous chairman of the House of Commons Intelligence and Security Committee, a very experienced political figure, has pointed out that there is a great danger of the politicization of the senior levels of the intelligence community. It's a danger that has been pointed to in America, of course, as well. We must try to preserve the independence and professional integrity and objectivity of the intelligence community. And there is no doubt that some in that community have been anxious to please their political masters. There's also no doubt that some political leaders have pushed very hard to get the kind of information they wanted, a case of the wish being father to the fact. And as you'll recall, in the case of the United States intelligence, when the CIA didn't turn up the intelligence that the Pentagon officials wanted, they simply set up their own rival intelligence group, which gave them the answers they wanted. So there are great dangers in the politicization of intelligence, and we should learn from these reports. The Butler report, it's true, doesn't find any individual to blame, but it's a very good account of the systemic failure. And the systemic failure had very serious consequences. Let's not forget that it led to a war in which scores of coalition troops have been killed and injured. Thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians have been killed and injured. There's been huge destruction of Iraq's economic infrastructure, which is going to take years to reconstruct. And the war has undoubtedly weakened the effort against al-Qaeda by diverting resources and by giving the terrorists fresh targets just across the border from the Middle East countries where they've been based. It has had very serious consequences, and we have the very serious problem now of trying to find an honorable exit for our coalition forces from Iraq.
And Nick Fielding, this question of whether or not, or the politicization of intelligence, that how is that going to play into what we were discussing before, and that is the political ramifications of this for Tony Blair and his government?
Well, I agree with everything that Professor Wilkinson said, indeed, and I think that this is a major problem, which is fairly well highlighted by the Butler report. He's made a number of recommendations to try and stop this happening in the future. For example, saying that the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee in the future should be in his last post. In other words, he shouldn't be beholden to another agency in the same way that maybe some people might think that John Scarlett was beholden to MI6, indeed he's gone on to that job. And that there should be a much stronger assessment staff, for example, and that another absolutely vital thing, which it doesn't appear to have happened, and this is the most basic and fundamental thing, if you have information which comes from a very dubious source or a source which is not entirely known or trusted, it behoves you to attach a warning, a health warning, to that intelligence. Now, it didn't happen in this case at all, as far as one can see. And this is ABC, as far as intelligence gathering goes. You need to know the quality of your evidence. And indeed, one knows that the intelligence services have very, very strict methods for determining the quality of a piece of information. Those systems were not in place this time round. And I find it very, very hard myself to understand how professionals in this field failed in this particular respect, and we need to be absolutely sure that this doesn't happen in the same way in the future. And I think it's that area where Butler will have an impact. He will have an impact on the machinery of intelligence, and let's hope this kind of failure doesn't happen in the future. But what he will not affect, really, because he hasn't looked at it and he doesn't have the remit, is the political process itself, and that is where there is still big gaps to be looked at.
All right, we're going to take a call now from Gilbert, Arizona. Hi, You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you for giving me a chance to speak on your show.
Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask, what are the mechanisms to ensure that if intelligence decides to give a report that is contrary to what the regime wants to do, for example, a country wants to go to war and intelligence gives a report that says, no, we shouldn't go to war, what protects the intelligence from, you know, people like the president firing the chief of intelligence saying, hey, look, you didn't do your job, that's not what I want to hear, and stuff like that?
All right, thanks for your question. I'm going to ask Professor Wilkinson to respond to that, and thanks so much for calling.
Well, that's a very good question, and sadly, the answer is that in many cases, the intelligence community is not protected, and they are overwhelmed by the political authority, and their material is simply dressed up in a way which presents it as justification for policy. It's a case of policy driving intelligence instead of good intelligence informing good policy making. And that is the problem that Nick Fielding and I were discussing earlier. I think we have to also take into account another major problem which emerged in the Butler inquiry, and that is where you have expertise in a particular area, for example, weapons of mass destruction, you should at least make sure that the top intelligence experts in that particular area are given all the information that comes into the hands of the authorities so that they can assess it and give their informed assessment as part of the intelligence effort. Now, in the case of the weapons of mass destruction intelligence on Iraq, it's clear that the defense intelligence experts in Britain on WMD were not given that opportunity. And this came out very clearly in the evidence to the Hutton inquiry. And it has been publicized again as a result of the Butler inquiry. And I think it just shows how meticulous we must be in our intelligence procedures to make sure that the genuine experts in various fields are drawn upon in order to get the very best information and assessment, because that is what is needed.
All right, thanks so much. Paul Wilkinson is a professor of international relations at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He joined us by phone from his home there. Joining us now to talk about the political implications of the Butler Report and the findings of the Senate Intelligence Committee is Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he joins us from the studio at Brookings. Thanks for being on Talk of the Nation today, Michael.
Thank you, Lynn.
Michael, is it possible that no politician in the U.S. will be held accountable for the misuse of intelligence in the lead-up to Iraq?
Well, I suppose it's possible that no one will be directly held accountable in the sense of being fired. But I think that clearly President Bush is running for re-election, a wounded man compared to what he was a year and a half ago. And part of the reason is the American voters' general view that the Iraq war may not have been the imminent, urgent necessity President Bush portrayed it as. I'm not trying to go to the other extreme and saying that Mr. Bush's policy was wrong-headed, but I think some of the haste, some of the imminence, some of the urgency, and therefore the lack of coalition strength and the lack of proper planning for the post-Saddam period that went along with that rush may be blamed in part on the degree to which Mr. Bush got carried away by the intelligence or misused it or over-dramatized it. And, you know, he's in a very competitive re-election race, which is not what his advisors expected a year and a half ago.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from Louise, and she's in Hudson, North Carolina. Hi, Louise.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
My question is, since this report has shown that, or is saying, that the CIA and the FBI and the others have been so lax and have had bad information, how do we know what's going on right now then? Well, I mean, who's minding the store now? If they have had that bad intelligence, then what kind of danger are we in now? I mean, are they getting any better at the intelligence? And ultimately, it has to come down to the two men, Blair and Bush, who said, we will go to war.
Michael Hanlon, I mean, that this question indicates a pretty strong mistrust. I don't know how widespread that is, but a mistrust on the part of the intelligence and political leadership. Thanks for your call, Louise, by the way.
Thank you.
Well, it's a very good question. It's a very serious question, of course, because it's focused on our country's future security, and I think it's very legitimate. But I think we have to therefore be careful to say what went wrong with intelligence on Iraq and also 9/11 and other things, and what went right, instead of just bringing down the entire intelligence community as if the entire thing is fundamentally off base, which is a bit of the tone of the Senate report, and I thought that was regrettable. If you look at the Iraq issue by itself, I think you have to break it down into three separate issues. On the nuclear weapons issue, it's true the intelligence community did a poor job, over-dramatized the threat, got a lot of things wrong, and needs to be held accountable in that particular bureau. But I think on the supposed connections between Saddam and al-Qaeda, the intelligence community was exactly right, and it was the Bush administration that exaggerated and misused the information. And then finally, on the chemical and biological weapons issue, the intelligence community was wrong and did some poor work at times, but frankly, it was a situation where it was understandable to be wrong, because Saddam had used these weapons before, had prevented inspectors from verifying them, and it was perfectly reasonable to think he still harbored some, and they're very hard to find, by the way. You can squirrel them away in very small places, and even hide small factories to make them in small places. So I don't think the intelligence community totally botched the job, and therefore I'm not as nervous as some people about our future security. I want to go in and fix the specific things that went wrong without implying that the entire community is somehow off base or incompetent. That's not fair. And to reassure, at least in my view, Louise, your worries, I don't think we have to feel that our security is in that great of a jeopardy.
Nick Fielding, how would you assess the intelligence in Britain at this point?
Well, I go along with the general thrust of what Michael is saying. I mean, I think that one shouldn't imagine that these organizations, these huge and extremely expensive organizations, one might add, are completely useless. They do extraordinarily good work, and Lord Butler today praised the work of the intelligence services and made the point very reasonably that, of course, one always hears about the failures but never about the successes, and I think that is a very important point to bear in mind. And I would also add, in relation to the United States, I mean, some evidence that's come out recently shows, for example, that over Osama, within the agency itself, within the CIA, there was a tremendous amount of knowledge and information, and very accurate it was, too, the material brought out in the books by Anonymous, the latest one, Imperial Hubris, and the previous book, show that at least some people within these agencies were very much on the ball, and the problems arose at a more senior level, at the level of senior management within the agencies. And I think there is this problem, which I think Professor Wilkinson alluded to, which is a problem of politicization, and one has to struggle, I think, very, very hard to make sure that information, extremely critical strategic information, is given in as pure and unadulterated a form as possible to the consumers within government that can make decisions which will affect all of our lives.
All right. Thanks so much, Nick. Nick Fielding is a senior reporter for the Sunday Times of London. He joined us by phone from his home in Oxford. We were also joined by Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at Brookings Institution. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.